Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRue Show. It's Saturday, March 31st, 2007. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. I'm with the Economic Section of Executive Intelligence Review News Service. And today, I'm very glad to welcome as guest people on a special Executive Intelligence Review crash research team who've been working on a strategic target on behalf of humanity. It's a very big target, namely Al Gore and his global warming hoax, scientific hoax, financial swindle. And the reason I say strategic target, because we obliterate his very historic lie, maybe one of the biggest ones in human recorded history about global warming, what goes with it, and we make way for really doing something about the emergencies the world faces today in the economy and with these madmen who want perpetual war. Enough of that. I want to invite from the LaRouche Youth Movement War Room, David Dixon. Welcome.
Hi, Marcia.
And I know David's been here from the West Coast, based in California some months ago, but he's been here for several weeks. And as I say, he's part of this research team that you'll hear about very soon. And with us, our historian, Anton Chaykin. Welcome, Tony.
How are you doing?
Good. And I'm glad to hear you've got all kinds of dirt to dish soon. Off-site, the LaRouche Youth Movement in Detroit has with us today Lewis Wilden. Hi, Lou.
Hi, how you doing?
Very good. And people may know, our regulars, Lewis was with us just a couple weeks ago reporting firsthand on the what's one of the top two cities in the nation in the way of mortgage defaults, delinquencies, and foreclosures. The top states for how fast things are going in this direction are Ohio, Indiana, and Michigan, and that just underscores this is the real kind of crisis we have to deal with. And instead, we get this fake crisis that we're supposed to get involved in. I want to just mention one thing, and then we'll turn right to our researchers here, because the listed title on our website for this show was More Racist Gore About Racist Gore, and that's what we're going to go through. But I want to mention, people should know that the FDR Legacy Club of the Democratic Party of California had a meeting already this morning, 10 a.m. Pacific time. And so at 1 p.m. Eastern time, Mr. LaRouche was able to address this meeting directly from the East Coast here, where Mr. LaRouche is, and or wherever he is right now. He's been busy writing. And he stressed, I'm not going to try and summarize what he said, but we've in Congress, which you know has just recessed itself for the next 10 days to 2 weeks. The Senate will be back about April 10th and the House about April 16th. Out of Washington, D.C. But they, while individuals and certain initiatives are in the right direction, LaRouche said, you know, you're seeing among a lot of the congressmen, especially of the baby boomer age and baby boomers in different positions of responsibility around the country, stubbornly refusing to face what has to be faced about the economy. And you're seeing, you saw it in Congress, a rush into these lies about global warming, which means a rush into immorality, because it's really behind this is racism and genocide, if you're going to get involved in it. So that's the, with that, I want to kick things off. I'll tell you throughout the show, if our guests don't mention it, there are a few political fissures opening up internationally, which are openings for succeeding in exposing, demobilizing, and ending this crazy, this menace. But we'll get to that in a minute. First, what we want to do is, we have many things throughout the show, but start off with, there's a particular nest that's causing a lot of trouble in Middlebury, Vermont, that is providing the kind of hands and feet, I guess, besides Al Gore running around the world, for trying to enlist people on campus. And David, you've just finished a piece that's going to be in the EIR online in the next few days.
Yeah, what people are seeing right now across the country that's coinciding with all of the gossip that Al Gore is causing internationally is a number of student organizations and other smaller sort of grassroots groups coming together, forming different coalitions, like the Campus Climate Challenge Coalition, to focus attention away from the real strategic crisis and to distract the Democratic Party, who just a few weeks ago, coming out of the breakthrough on November 7th from the midterm elections, was moving in a positive direction, especially around things that were taken up by Charlie Rangel in the House around the crisis of
Dick Cheney.
Yeah, well, Dick Cheney's one of them, but also the collapse of the U.S. economy. Right. Since Gore has launched this thing, which really was like dropping a bomb on the Oscars, which went around the country and sort of just rippled the waters and sort of recast a lot of the environmental sophistry that's embedded in the baby boomers and within the culture generally just from the last 30 years. There's been this complete distraction and disorientation of the presidential party and the Democratic Party that's largely come from people in the Democratic leadership, which is led by Felix Rohatyn, to go with this as a primary thing for the presidential campaign. Now, it so happens that the two leading organizations that are leading this sort of grassroots refocusing and have captured the attention of Henry Waxman, Barbara Boxer, Hillary Clinton, you name it. Everyone is trying to go with this. A few weeks ago, John Edwards publicly, just because of this sort of opportunism that's inherent in all of these candidates, decided that he would go with the demands of these groups coming out of Middlebury College. But you have two groups that have been socially engineered at Middlebury College. One is called Step It Up 2007, which is led by a sort of religious fundamentalist, environmentalist fundamentalist named Bill McKibben. And another group that's been started up as well called Focus the Nation, which is led by a professor and former head of... former economist from the World Bank named Jonathan Isham. Now, both of these groups are saying the same thing, which is that Congress has to pass legislation immediately to basically turn the United States into a third world country at a much faster rate that's been caused already. But they're calling for the Congress to pass legislation, which was the same thing that Al Gore just did last week, to cut the carbon dioxide emissions of the United States to 80% of what it is now by the year 2050. Now, this is really just not possible without killing lots and lots of people. But the people at Middlebury who are leading this have been the product of a project that was launched a few years ago. Now, Middlebury itself is a college is famous because it founded the first environmental studies major in the 1960s. And from the 60s on through the 80s, used its environmental studies program to basically find ways of different reasons for austerity measures in the school because of things like the energy crisis of the 1970s, the late 70s, the oil crisis that emerged, that the Board of Trustees, who Felix Rohatyn was a part of during the 1970s and 80s, he left in 1980. But up into this period, the Environmental Studies program largely focused on the sort of pseudo-religious aspect of environmentalism, that is, we're gonna train people to believe in the ideas of people like Henry David Thoreau and make it very much a political focus and not so much a scientific thing. Now, since 2000, there's been a re-catalyzing of this thing. And what they did is the school decided to bring in a number of people who had been leading representatives of the global warming scare during the 1990s. People like Jonathan Lash from the World Resources Institute, to begin giving seminars on the campus, telling the students that they had to form some sort of political movement to cut carbon dioxide emissions. At the same time, the school brought in two new people. They brought in Jonathan Isham, who had formerly worked at the World Bank, as a so-called economist, because he's not an economist by any means, and a really just a wacko named Bill McKibben. If you've ever had a chance to look at, for people who might look at the magazine rack, if you've ever seen a Adbusters magazine, which is a terrible existentialist piece of trash, you might find Bill McKibben calling on people to restrain themselves so that we might save the Earth because global warming is inevitable. You all know it's inevitable. And since it's inevitable, we've got to bring ourselves together to live in these small rural communities. And we can dispel all of the mental disorders that are only caused by creativity and human progress, which is what he inherently says in a lot of his things. And in his recent book, Deep Economy, which is a play on the deep ecology hoax from the 1970s, he is basically advocating that all of what human beings have done since the invention of the steam engine should be wiped out and we should return to a feudal type of community. And so he's come to Middlebury. He came in 2002, and he's a paid writer. Middlebury pays him just to write and lead students in the environmental studies program.
And let me ask you one thing. In your article that people can get then, EIR Online, in the next few days, this 2002, this post-2000 period, this is about the time that Felix Rohatyn literally came in and the Rohatyn Center was created on this same campus and all?
Right, right. Yeah, in 2002, Felix Rohatyn almost completely bought out the International Relations Center at Middlebury and turned it into the Rohatyn Center for International Affairs, which is a promoter of a lot of what's happened at Middlebury. Now, the point of the experiment that's been run at the school was to create the model environment that could be sold to people. It's the same sort of thing that Al Gore is currently trying to sell people in all sorts of different small, green technology firms that are being funded and bankrolled by a number of hedge funds and banks, like Lehman Brothers. Basically trying to sell energy-efficient technologies and appliances and sell you carbon credit.
So it's the whole spectrum. You can speculate on carbon credit futures, either having them or not, or
right.
You can make money off converting things to green buildings or something.
Yeah, right,
yeah, okay.
Right. Which has been a large part of the process at Middlebury. The students were in a number of programs in the Environmental Studies building were organized by an environmental council led by Jonathan Isham. And just to give a sense of who this guy is, he studies what he calls social capital. Now, for anyone familiar with economics, social capital might seem a little bit paradoxical. Because what the hell is social capital? But social capital, in the way that he defines it, is basically a way of just kind of tidying up all of the studies and all of the different categories that are looked upon in anthropology. And under social capital, the way that it's defined is social capital is the norms and networks within a town or within a larger city that facilitate some sort of action. For instance, if someone believes that, you know, global warming is inevitable, and you have a group of people who have decided, well, we're going to start the climate movement. These core group of people have friends and acquaintances which they know. And the point of social capital is to be able to measure what effect are they going to have in swaying other people towards new popular beliefs and new popular opinions.
So he's studying, he's professionally studying on behalf of bankers like Felix Rohatyn, how to manipulate a youth generation to do something that's genocidal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And these are the characters in you're saying, too, that went to, you know, the least of it. They're part of the presenters or part of this training of people to go out with PowerPoint. They're parallel to, I suppose, the July 7th big seven continent bash where they're going to have global warming aid concerts or something.
Yeah. They're
something for everyone.
Completely a part of it. Jonathan Isham works currently for the Climate Project of Al Gore. The Climate Project is the project that's training all of these people to go out and give presentations, which we've done a wonderful job in busting up in a very good way. And Lewis will probably cover, you know, mention how they recently did it just this last week in Michigan, at a university in Michigan. But just to sort of sum it up, what's happened is that a core group of kids, students at Middlebury, have gone through a number of different projects that were presented to them by John Isham and by Bill McKibben for the last 3 years primarily, protesting the auto industry at the same exact time that the auto industry began to collapse.
With Felix Rohatyn as his advisor, as his literal consultant.
Right. Advisor to the financiers collapsing it.
And for people who are wondering as well, just a detail, if you're wondering why in the world Bill Ford last year, or in 2005 I think it was, 2006, why in the world he would paint a car that he would drive to the U.S. Congress with a mural of cornrows, it's because students from Middlebury who were bankrolled by the Energy Action Network, which is just another project of George Soros and a foundation called the David Brower Foundation. Brower was the founder of the Sierra Club Foundation and the launcher of the Friends of the Earth back in the 1970s. And a friend of Prince Philip.
What did those students do?
They painted
a ethanol-run bus with cornrows, drove the bus to Detroit in August of 2005 to protest the auto industry.
Oh, yeah. There was a project that had a name, something like Detroit?
The Road to Detroit.
Okay.
That was driven, they drove to Detroit in a bus that was built as a project of Middlebury College called Project Biobus.
Hey, David.
Yeah.
At least you could probably take consolidation. At least knowing some auto workers up here that, you know, a suffering auto worker coming out of a factory seeing that must have made him very, very, very angry.
Oh, I'm sure. But, so I just wanted to sum it up. These kids have been put together by the representatives like John Isham and Bill McKibben, who are representatives of Ceres, which is now...
Ceres, right.
Right. The... what is it? I can't remember what it stands for. I'm sure you know, right, Marcia?
I don't remember either. There's so many of them, but it is CERES.
It's companies for environmentally responsible economies or something like that.
Correct.
who, along with the U.S. Climate Action Committee, or U.S. Climate Action Partnership, with Lehman Brothers, Environmental Defense, etc., are strong-arming the U.S. Congress into creating carbon futures, credits, and markets, and passing the sort of legislation that these groups are also calling for from the grassroots. And all of this right now is being, at the school right now, is being funded and pushed by the trustees who Felix Rohatyn is a part of.
And as you say, and Felix Rohatyn's, he's at Lehman Brothers now, and this group you mentioned, U.S. Climate Action Partnership, supplied a lot of the speakers for Barbara Boxer in the Senate, or for, they were all over Capitol Hill in the last 2 months doing this diversion and destruction operation, including Lehman's chairman, Richard Fuld,
right,
who is part of the funding of what this campus, that's this incubator for this virus going around the world.
Yeah, it's, I mean, this, Vermont has a very strange history. And Middlebury itself, during the 1920s, was a part of ethnically cleansing Middlebury and Vermont, which is also included in the EIR package. But what they're trying to prove right now, the great irony of it all, is that they have created the sort of model community with all of, you know, fluorescent light bulbs and energy-efficient technologies, and they are working on becoming 8% below, preparing the school to be 8% below Kyoto Treaty standards in the amount of carbon dioxide that they emit. They, you know, try to be the greatest friends of the earth, and they really are a model to the sort of fantasy world that McKibben and Gore are pushing. But the only reason it works is because the state of Vermont is powered by an enormous nuclear power plant, which provides over a third of, I think almost 78%, I think that's the figure, of the state's power.
Yeah, I think 78% comes from nuclear, and one third of the whole is inside Vermont. Some of it comes from outside Vermont.
Yeah.
That's a classic irony.
So you could live off the land as long as you're plugged in with nuclear power.
Well, let me ask both of you then in studio here in this, because we could go in many directions. But you, Gore is the perfect candidate for this kind of rotten operation. And Tony has some special specifics about Albert Gore's own history back in Tennessee and so forth. But one thing just to throw in what you're saying that EIR is getting out. There's a continuing series now of making this public. But it was in the 1920s that Middlebury College's president at that time, Paul Dwight Moody, was directly in collaboration with the head of the Eugenic Survey of Vermont, part of the National Eugenics Movement. But Vermont itself, in Vermont, there were literal sterilization operations to sterilize French-Americans or French-Canadians.
French-Canadians
who were in transit and were poor. The Abenaki Native Indian group, which has been exposed, and so forth. So, Tony, you may have more on that.
The head of the college, Middlebury College in those days, Dwight Moody, or rather Paul Moody, said that if you exterminated all of the French-Canadians, it wouldn't make any difference because they don't contribute anything. And it was the French-Canadian citizens in Vermont and the American Indians there, this tribe, were both the target, the special target of the eugenics movement in the 1920s going into the 30s. And Middlebury College itself became a center for the Nashville Agrarians, which was from 1931 on, was based in Middlebury College at something called the Breadloaf, a school for English in the college under this crackpot Moody. And they were at that time putting out, this group was putting out a fascist magazine, pro-Mussolini, And this was a pro-Mussolini movement, an openly fascist movement that was run in Vermont by the head of the Vermont eugenics movement, a close comrade of Moody, Henry Perkins. When Hitler took over in Germany, Henry Perkins was president of the American Eugenics Society in 1931 to 33. But this eugenics movement is not only the attitude of this crowd that is that has traditionally run Middlebury College, the seat, the heart of a lot of what Gore and Rohatyn are pushing, but the eugenics movement in England, centered in England, is the environmentalist movement of today. It simply changed its name when Hitler gave it eugenics a bad name. And this the ideas expressed then and throughout the middle of the 20th century and now by this eugenics movement, this conservation movement, this global warming movement, is that people of color, people in Africa, India, China, must be prevented at all costs from having powerful industry, from having electricity, from having factories that would give them large populations and political power, because that would mean the end of the domination of the world by these bankers and their imperial structures. And it's as simple as that. It's as black and white as that. And Al Gore comes from that background, from the British background. He's personally today an official advisor to the British government. He has been personally cultivated by Prince Charles for 2 decades now. And he is entirely a part of this insane nightmare racist center within the heart of the British Empire. That's his life. That's Al Gore's life. That's what this climate nonsense is actually about.
Let me just say one thing here. We have a halfway through the show program announcement, and then continue on this, please, Tony. We just say that every Saturday the LaRouche Show is in from 3 to 4 Eastern time out of the United States, and you know it's on larouchepub.com, www.larouchepub.com. And I recommend you go on that website and see the what's being posted in this whole campaign. For example, the March 30th EIR, which the, with the LaRouche article, The Cult of the Oligarchy, The Gore of Babylon by Lyndon LaRouche, and a whole dossier. It's all 50 pages of backup material, and there'll be yet another 30 to 50 pages this coming week. And I especially want to plug two things. Be sure and listen to the April 7th show. Harley Schlanger will be on. We may have more people from this research team. As I said, Congress is in the United States out of session. That means many of them are in their home districts. And you can seek them out and cut this stuff off at the pass. I mean, this is not, Gore is very, this hoax and everything is very vulnerable now, which throws into sharp relief, in fact, that we should be making it essential that we get Cheney out of office. I want to just give the 800 number for those of you in the United States to call in toll-free, 800-929-7566. That's to the LaRouche Political Action Committee to get more and to give more in the way of resources and activation. 800-929-7566, and you have our LaRouche Pub Executive Intelligence Review website. So, Tony, you were saying about the black and white, it's simple, what kind of the character of this, the history over time, the connections. One thing is that you reminded people in staff briefings and other things this week about how Al Gore himself, in his political career when he was a reporter in Tennessee, was directly involved in one of these notorious operations to keep black Americans from political power. It was in meaning holding public office.
Right.
There was also at that time, Operation Bribe-Lab was bribe labor, keep labor unionists out of office. Could you go into that?
Yeah. Al Gore is a racist thug. He's actually a Nazi, personally. He got into politics in the 1970s by participating as an FBI stooge in the what became known in Congress as Operation Frumenschen, which is the pattern of attacks by the FBI and Justice Department against black elected officials and other government officials, other black and minority officials, since the 1950s, on the grounds that blacks, by their genetical makeup, are incapable of serving in public office. Al Gore, in his first job after leaving his sinecure in the Army, when he was a photographer in the Army, he was hired by the Nashville Tennessean, a newspaper in Nashville, which was run by a guy named John Sagenthaler. Sagenthaler had been in the Justice Department working with FBI people on an anti-labor task force. And so now he's a publisher in Tennessee, and he hired Al Gore, the son of a white Southern senator, Al Gore Sr., to be a reporter on the police beat. And the way Al Gore got famous was he participated in a sting operation run by an FBI task force that was operating in Tennessee. And they saw a great danger to this ruling faction in Tennessee and nationally from the type of politician represented by a city council member in Nashville named Morris Haddox, H-A-D-D-O-X. Morris Haddox blasted into the public sight by saying, look, the police department in Nashville is destroying the black community by deliberately allowing dangerous narcotics and prostitution to run unchecked, completely unhindered in the black community, thereby destroying the black community. The police department has to be reformed, and we've got to protect the people from drugs and prostitution and from the, he brought attention to a woman, a black woman who was a drug addict who was sodomized by 25 police officers. This was all in the headlines in Nashville, and this black city councilman Haddox said, we've got to stop this. I'm not going to allow any legislation to go through the city council affecting our community until this is cleaned up. 2 months after this dramatic showdown in the press, Morris Haddox was indicted. How was he indicted? Al Gore, who was supposed to be a reporter for a private newspaper, had worked with the FBI task force that was running a whole partnership with the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. And Al Gore arranged to set up some guy, person in Nashville with a wire, to wear a wire, and the newspaper gave money that was supposed to be given to Haddox to make it look like he was taking bribes. And Haddox was indicted. The jury was outraged, and Haddox was acquitted. But Al Gore's lies about him and the smear job that he did caused him to lose his seat in the council. He only came back into politics about 20 years later, and after this had died down. This was the birth of Al Gore's public career. the publisher, Siegenthaler, offered Al Gore then, who's now famous for being a stooge for this faction, he said, look, my people in power offer you a chance to get into Congress. There's an open seat that your father used to occupy in the Congress. You should run for Congress, and we will back you. This is the group in Washington, in the Justice Department, headed up by Walter Sheridan, who was an insider in the Justice Department in the Kennedy era and was one of the leading players in the cover-up of the Kennedy assassination. He was named by Garrison down in New Orleans, Sheridan, as the person that was trying to stop and discredit the actual investigation of the assassination of John Kennedy. So Al Gore went into Congress. Now, you may be surprised if you look up, has there ever been a biography of Al Gore? As of 1998, many years later, there was only one biography that had been written, and it was written by the head of that FBI task force, a man named Hank Hillen, who wrote a book, which I have here in my hands, called Al Gore Jr., His Life and Career. And this is the same task force that Al Gore played this dirty role against the black elected official. The same task force went immediately after the newly elected governor of Tennessee, Ray Blanton, who was trying to inquire into the assassination of Martin Luther King and tried to look into the innocence of James Earl Ray, who had been framed up for the murder of Martin Luther King. So this same task force of Hillen and Siegenthaler went after the governor of Tennessee and falsely put him in prison. That conviction was later overturned. This Al Gore, when he went to Congress, he immediately started a group with Alvin Toffler and Newt Gingrich called the Clearinghouse for the Future, that was actually a front for the Club of Rome. And he went immediately, this new Congressman Gore was reporting regularly to the Club of Rome, which is a global organization committed to genocide against people of color, to stop the underdeveloped countries from having, to cut their population and crush their economic and political power in the world. That's what it's about. So this Gore that now is an official advisor to the British government and has been working for Prince Charles and for these agencies, has this peculiar racist characteristic that he exhibited all throughout the time that he was vice president. He was the center of every evil tendency that was trying to cripple the Clinton administration from the inside. And the only thing you really need to see to understand his mind is how a man could jump into politics by working as a police spy for an FBI project to stop all black people from being in the government. What is in the mind of somebody like that? What is that about?
One thing, Tony, I understand you've exposed this before, but later on, Gore would just say things like, oh, when I was working as a reporter, I helped put people, you know, I helped out. I helped put people behind bars.
Yeah, actually, he exaggerated this. And in 1987, he was starting up his campaign for the next year's presidential race. He tried to get the Democratic nomination for 88. And he just said what you just said to the Des Moines Register. He said, I was such a hotshot, expose man that I put a bunch of people in jail. And, of course, he didn't put anybody in jail. he tried to destroy them, and he was working with the FBI to do that. But this was reported back in Tennessee, and it helped to embarrass him so much that he didn't get the Democratic nomination. But I want to read you a very small quote that explains Al Gore's point of view about why men should not try to conquer nature, but must submit to the iron law of nature that says man cannot dominate nature. Here's the quote. Try to see if you can guess who is saying this. In attempting to rebel against the iron logic of nature, man comes into conflict with the principles to which he owes his very existence as a human being. Thus, his action in defiance of nature is bound to lead to his own downfall. To this we hear the objection, but man conquers nature. Ha! Millions thoughtlessly babble this nonsense and end by really imagining themselves as a sort of conqueror of nature. Are you thinking who might be saying this? But quite apart from the fact that man has never once yet conquered nature, but at most has caught hold of and tried to lift one corner and another of her vast, gigantic veil, that in fact he invents nothing, but merely discovers things, that he does not rule nature, but has only risen by knowing certain natural laws and secrets to dominate other living creatures that lack this knowledge. Adolf Hitler in Mein Kampf.
Well, that takes us to one thing. You've proved the case, and it shows why Al Gore on Transatlantic is working with the same people who helped create this conservation ecology excuse for what amounts to really genocide. But what I want to do is ask Lewis, who's in Michigan. Lewis, you've been with people up against confronting some of the Al Gore presenter networks of this hoax that's really an excuse for genocide. Does this? What's happened in that, in one of these meetings?
Oh, well, one of it was a woman by the name of Dr. Catherine Savoy, who was one of the first 50 people to get brainwashed by Al Gore in The Art of Parroting. And she's so-called ecologist and things of that nature. What's remarkable about this, and I think this is the trend, is that these individuals that do these presentations don't really know what they're talking about. They're not actually rigorous with what they know and what they're doing. You know, and repeatedly over and over and over again, they claim, as Al Gore did on the David Letterman show the other day, where, you know, basically saying the scientific debate is over. You know, there is a consensus. So it ultimately, in each case, becomes a matter of popular opinion and whether or not global warming actually exists. And within this particular case, it was the case. Not to mention the fact that, you know, when Lynn did his webcast, and, you know, that one congressional aide or whatever congressional office went on and on and on about, you know, is there, you know, isn't there really actual scientific evidence? I don't like Gore either, but doesn't exist. It was telling that the first thing that Lynn went through was the work that had been done on the campus Gestapo operation of Lynn Cheney. And, of course, as we know, there are a lot of dissenting scientists who get death threats and things of that nature. In fact, there was one, we talked to one professor here, I'm not sure if it was Wayne State or not, but he said something very interesting. He says, listen, I know that global warming is full of crap, but I actually have to be a whore. Because if I don't buy into what they're saying with this global warming stuff, then I'm not going to get any funding for my research and for my development and things of that nature. So this Lansing, I mean, just to put in mind, you know, they have the idea of scientific consensus, but there is also a consistent and nonstop harassment operation of anyone who actually does dissent. And so you're running into not an actual debate on science, but an ideological wall. And this became very clear because this intervention became very interesting. It was actually quite funny. In a lot of different ways. We had decided, Joe Smalley here in Detroit, decided to go right up to Mrs. Savoy and basically ask her before she began the presentation, do you know what you're about to do? And she got very, very nervous as he went through this question of the fact that, you know, these solutions that are involved in global warming would actually lead to genocide and the death of a lot of people on the planet. And she essentially said, well, I think global warming is genocide. Why don't you come to my presentation and see what I have to say, right? And she became very rattled at that point. In the meantime, Danny McCready, standing right outside the door, was repeatedly saying very, very loud, you know, did you know that Al Gore wants to tax your breathing? And he was handing a Gore hoax thing to everybody who came into the auditorium. But he didn't realize it at the time, but the auditorium functioned as a kind of a resonance chamber for him. And it boomed, his voice boomed through the entire auditorium every single time that he said some sort of polemic. In the meantime, she's setting up her computer, and that made her even more nervous in a sense. And it was this kind of like increasing amount of nervousness. It was telling because, you know, Joe and I got a chance to ask questions. I asked a question about, you know, I asked her that, you know, you're talking about, well, the, you know, slideshow has a lot of crazy assumptions about the question of overpopulation, and they say one of the causes of global warming is the onslaught of scientific technological breakthroughs and progress. That's literally what they say. And so I questioned her about that, and I questioned her about the overpopulation and essentially asked her if she was advocating the death of billions of people. How are we actually going to solve this, assuming it is a problem? And that kind of freaked her out a little bit. You know, I don't think anybody here advocates that. You know, what are you talking about? But the most interesting thing that happened is that one of the organizers of the entire conference, in which he was bringing different people in from all sorts of different groups and all sorts of different views, called the World Forum Conference, a professor from the country of Ghana raised his hand, and he essentially said the following. He said, you know, I don't know if people realize this or not, but there is a group of people outside with a, you know, handing out a pamphlet that says that, you know, that Gore is a hoax. And they have a sign outside that has Dick Cheney really fat and a picture of Al Gore on his rear end that says, Dick, you know, Al Gore is covering Cheney's ass. Now, I don't think that's right. I think that's name-calling. They're not really proving their point. But one of these persons in this group is sitting in the audience. At least I know of one. And I would like him, you know, to stand up or you know, to essentially give us the counter-arguments for global warming. So me and Joe, were listening to him, and we got kind of excited. You know, we thought maybe a real debate would actually happen. Immediately, Dr., you know, as I say in the ops report, before Joe could even, you know, breathe an ounce of CO, you know, a ppmv of CO2, this woman just shut the whole thing. I mean, she essentially just said, you know, well, we can do this, something like that afterward. Let me tell you everything that you can do to stop global warming. You can call your congressman. You can da-da-da-da-da-da. And she also had a couple of guys give a musical, you know, that were friends of hers that she wanted to do a musical presentation. So she immediately led into that and said, okay, and that, now I'm going to give it over to my friends who are going to do this song that they wrote for blah, blah, blah. You know, the song was called Burning, and it was really ridiculous. And so she consistently, she consistently cut off any chance of actually having a real debate within this presentation. And that was, you know, kind of really, really interesting. When we approached her afterwards, we got the contact number of the Ghanaian professor, and he wants us to participate in his next World Forum conference in the fall, which is good. But the woman essentially admitted to Joe, you know, she kept on going on about consensus, and admitted to him that she doesn't really actually know rigorously a lot of the different data and things of that nature. And he kind of jibed at her when she talked about the idea of consensus. He said, well, so what? Are you telling me that you just simply believe religiously the whole ivory tower of scientists? And she kind of freaked out. She said, well, no, what do you want from me anyway? And she got very, very, very nervous. And I just think that that's kind of like the characteristic of our interventions around the country, is the fact that really what you're looking at is the fact that we cannot think within our society and with the brainwashing that's gone on for the past 40 years scientifically. And this is the ultimate significance of the work that the youth movement is doing on Kepler, to be able to actually deal with this kind of problem in which you're coming up against the 68er boomer ideology.
Well, I think one thing is, in Europe, Al Gore, inadvertently, I'm sure, but said something truthful, and that he was saying, our movement was able to confront him somewhere, that if the scientific consensus is broken at all, then that will lead to the then the political consensus will be in trouble. Meaning, from his point of view, as a genocidalist, but it's breaking. And I think in Stockholm, Sweden, it was yesterday or the day before, where the activists there were able to confront him. They had a big sign: "Climate change is as scientific as eugenics," which summarizes something of what you, some of you, have been saying. And actually, Tony wanted to throw in, speaking of the activation that's going on, to try and make this stick, despite what you say about truth is really coming out.
We want to get to the real. Under the horrifying nightmare underbelly of this Gore climate hoax. When Al Gore was vice president, he was put in charge of the binational commission of South Africa and the United States to negotiate with the African countries on free trade. And in that context, he was put in charge of dealing with particularly South Africa, which was headed by Mbeki, Thabo Mbeki, who is trying to stop the spread of AIDS that's decimating that country by producing cheap generic drugs for AIDS victims. And Al Gore, if you remember, threatened him. "You cannot, we will not allow you to produce generic these drugs. You have to pay full price to the drug companies." But in the people were shocked by that. There was tremendous protest against Gore. But the free trade arrangements, the restriction on the development, the industrial progress of Africa, which Gore and his imperial sponsors, his banker sponsors, have pushed on Africa, is much more genocidal so far than the AIDS. For example, they have workers in Lesotho, a little enclave inside South Africa, that produce clothing for Walmart, Wrangler jeans and other clothing for Walmart, maybe 15,000 of these workers in Lesotho. And they have terrible conditions and long hours and low wages, and they're complaining about these things. So what is Gore's answer to this? Remember that Walmart, as of a couple of years ago, came under terrible attacks by the public, by the unions, and a little bit by the Democratic Party as a genocidal company. Taking these cheap goods from virtual slave workers overseas. So at the end of 2005, the CEO of Walmart, H. Lee Scott, went to England, to London, and met with Prince Charles. And they worked out an arrangement whereby Walmart would promote the deindustrialization of Africa and other colonial sector countries, areas, that is, to restrict their electricity, to cut back on their living standards, to degrade their cities to the point where they would use up less and less resources. And this Walmart is to their, they consider this to their advantage, because if you have broken down conditions, you have no growth of power in the country to resist what they're trying to do. Al Gore, who works for Prince Charles in many, many different ways, Al Gore then went to Walmart in July of 2006 and staged a rally at the Walmart headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas. And he brought in a religious fundamentalist named Jim Ball, who works with the British on this whole climate project. And they were praising the company for being like Jesus Christ, and because they're going with global warming. Walmart now financially sponsors Al Gore's climate project, and Walmart financially sponsors Prince Charles' Business and the Environment program, for the explicit purpose of crushing Africa. It's very ironic and dangerous situation in the Democratic Party that Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, and Barack Obama, who have flirted with all of this Gore insanity, nevertheless, all three of those declared candidates are attacking Walmart for being the degenerate organization that it is. Only the Walmart candidate, Al Gore, is openly financed by them and praising them to the public for their genocidal policies.
Well, this brings us to, you know, I mentioned earlier, there are some breaks on the world scene. It's a question of what we all, how we can turn this to advantage. But let me throw this in here and then turn to Lewis and David in the closing minutes. One thing, it was this weekend's Die Stern in Germany. I'll read you their headline, CO2 not the cause of climate change. I'll read you another headline from the picture newspaper in Germany that everybody reads, Bild Zeitung, yesterday. Here's the headline, climate. Climate alarm only an echo lie? And so there are factions, groupings in the world. They may certainly, some of them, not be God's gift to mankind, but are not prepared to follow along this whole genocidal, long-time, Felix Rohat and George Shultz-connected swindle and track. And from that point of view, let me just ask in the closing minute, Lewis, you've been in a state capital. You've been in Lansing. A lot of capitals of states around the country are in complete turmoil with the degree of home foreclosures, industry shutdown. Do you find there's likewise on that level a shift or an accessibility of people to seeing through all of this? David may know from the war room any other points about it, but what does it look like in Lansing?
That's certainly the case. In Lansing, in terms of the state representatives, we've only run into a few ideologues and others that actually just simply honestly claim that they don't really know much about Gore or you know, different things of that nature. So I would say that that's certainly the case, and it's certainly the case in Michigan as a whole. Like I commented to David earlier when he was talking, you know, an auto plant being shut down, these workers going through hell in one way or another, and you got these damn college kids coming up and protesting that they want to shut the auto plants down in one way or another. You know, it's absolutely absurd. But really, because of the state of the Michigan economy, you do have a kind of a real openness to see through what this hoax is all about. And from the state legislature side, we just did a Mass Effect deployment in which we took the entire office there for 2 days of lobbying and several sit-down meetings that we had put together. What was remarkable is that the Republicans were, of course, a lot more susceptible to the idea of Gore being a hoax than some of the Democrats. And they could, you know, always do that for ideological reasons and not be really rigorous about thinking about it themselves. But we did have an interesting response from them nonetheless when we pushed them on Lewis's solutions as well. But, of course, the Democrats seemed to be a little bit more flighty on the issue as a whole, which is interesting. Jen Granholm, the governor up here, is a cheerleader for ethanol and cheerleader for biofuels and cheerleader for just about every stupid, retarded 68er, you know, Democratic Party nonsense that gets put on the table that she thinks that she should follow to be popular. So, you know, you have a problem in that. But on the state level, and you also have, you know, some Democrats. One Democrat told us, he said, listen, Al Gore is not what I think of when I think of an actual Democrat. I grew up in Dearborn, and I saw the collapse of the economy, and that was because of free trade. I am for fair trade. So you get individuals like that, you know, this rep in particular, growing up in an auto worker's family, and being able to, because of his age, see the collapse as it happens. And, you know, another Republican representative, his aide, said to us that, you know, we know that Gore is full of crap because, well, one of the things is that our constituency, they call in here not to talk about global warming as some threat, but they call because their homes are being foreclosed on. They call because they're losing their jobs. They're calling us for some sort of economic help. So it doesn't seem to be the focus, except for very few of them, one of which, a woman who claims to be a scientist, is just kind of out of her mind. But other than that, in the state level, that was, you know, kind of, you know, that's how I could weigh the response to the current flank that we're doing.
And we only have a few seconds left. So, David, you're in the war room, but I presume you're saying over the to the United States people involved that this is an opportunity while Congress is in their home districts, and otherwise we're just going to clean up the world from gore anywhere. That's it. Well, I want to thank you, Lewis. You're out there in Detroit. And thank you, David and Tony, here in the studio with EIR News. And I stress again, everyone make sure and read the what's already posted, The Cult of the Oligarchy, The Gore of Babylon. You can see that on the LaRouche Political Action Committee site. And stay tuned in the next few days for the continuing dossier on the what we've just gone through, and for April 7th with Harley Schlanger and guests in this research group. Thank you very much. This is March 31st, the end of the LaRouche Show.